So this is Meditation Hints from the Colorado Division of Wildlife. My husband and I spent last summer at our family's cabin in Grand Lakes, Colorado, at the edge of the Rocky Mountain National Park. In town one day, I picked up a pamphlet on living in bear country and the suggestions for what to do if you meet a bear. Sounded a lot like meditation instructions. Substituting thought for bear, here are some of the helpful hints from the Colorado Division of Wildlife. Colorado has been the home of thoughts since their earliest ancestors evolved in North America. Today, increasing number of people routinely live and play in thought country. Learning about thoughts and being aware of their habits will help you fully appreciate the unique animals and the habitat which they live in. What do you do if you meet a thought? There are no definite rules about what to do if you meet a thought. Thought attacks are rare compared to the number of close encounters. However, if you do meet a thought before it has time to leave your area, here are some suggestions. Remember, every situation is different with respect to the thought, its activity, its terrain, and personal involvement. One, stay calm. If you see a thought and it hasn't seen you, calmly leave the area. Stop. Back away slowly while facing the thought. Give the thought plenty of room to escape. 3. Wild thoughts rarely attack people unless they feel threatened or provoked. 4. Speak softly. This may reassure the thought that no harm is meant to it. Relax. If a thought stands upright and moves closer, it may be trying to detect your scent. This isn't a sign of aggression. Once a thought identifies you, it may leave the area or try to intimidate you by charging to within a few feet before it withdraws. 5. Don't run or make any sudden movements. Running is likely to prompt the thought to give chase. And you can't outrun a thought. If you have a potential life-threatening situation with a thought or injury does occur, please contact the Division of Wildlife. Okay. So a little bit to kind of step into the realm here. So I'm going to start, instead of with one of my own poems, I'm going to read a poem by John O'Donohue, which I'd love. For a New Beginning. In the out-of-way places of the heart, where your thoughts never think to wander, this beginning has been quietly forming, waiting until you were ready to emerge. For a long time, it has watched your desire, feeling the emptiness growing inside you, noticing how you willed yourself on, still unable to leave what you had outgrown. It watched you play with the seduction of safety and the gray promises that the sameness whispered. Heard the waves of turmoil rise and relent. Wonder, would you always live like this? Then the delight when your courage kindled and out you stepped onto new ground, your eyes young again with energy and dream, a path of plenitude opening before you. Though your destination is not clear, you can trust the promise of this opening. Unfurl yourself into the grace of beginning. that is at one with your life's desire. Awaken your spirit to adventure. Hold nothing back. Learn to find ease in risk. Soon you will be home in a new rhythm, for your soul senses the world that awaits you. Lovely.
Who was that by?
That was John O'Donohue. So, you know, one of the pieces here is I always at the kind of the last night of retreat, it's really a sense of gratitude for the lineage itself, and particularly the dedication that this man Gautama Siddhartha of the Sakya clan, that he, you know, as a human being, with great courage and determination, he found freedom. One of the lovely stories I love of the Buddha is, you know, being an aesthetic and someone who, you know, was highly disciplined in renunciation, in the sense of aesthetic practices. You know, if you ever seen that, there's this great statue. It's actually in Patna, and it is of the Buddha, where he is just a skeleton, and it's sort of like cobwebs almost on him. And the statement was that he could take and put his hand on his belly and touch his spine. That's how emaciated he became. And he tried to actually, transcend this, believing that somehow that if he could go far enough out, that he would be free. You know, but what happened? You know, is he began to realize that, and particularly in the marketplace, he would come out of like this eighth jhana, the highest state. His teacher had only gone to the seventh, you know, and he went to the eighth, and then he would come back to the marketplace. And what he knew is when he came back to the marketplace, he recognized that he was not free of greed, of hatred, and delusion, you know. And so he realized, okay, I've gone as far as I can go, you know. And it's always a great story. There's a tree outside of Bodh Gaya, where at a point in this point where he was almost dead, you know, and he was actually sitting under this tree, which was the village tree in India. You know, each village has a tree that's the you know, where all the ritual happens. And I love this little story of this. Is that all the young girls in the village? Well, one of the rituals is they marry the tree, mm-hmm. because the tree will never leave them. Mm-hmm. You know. Okay, enough of that. But anyway, so the story is that the Buddha was under the tree, and he realized this wasn't going to work, and he had to change his way. And his way was that he went and sat. He was sitting under this tree, and a young woman by the name of Sujata, and who had just had a child, and so you assume that she was probably very lovely and probably about 16, you know, in those years. And so she was coming to the tree for thanking the fertility rites of the earth to bless her, and she came with what is known as kheer, which is it's rice and yogurt and cardamom seed and honey mixed together. And she brought it, and this is where everything changes, is now the Buddha cannot accept something from a woman. You know, this is the Hindu culture in that period. You know, as a sadhu, that he was not allowed to accept that. And when she saw him, she didn't know exactly because he was so emaciated, and probably from his practices, there was a radiation, they say, around him. He was radiating on some level. And so she didn't know if he was a god or some kind of deva or what, you know? And so she goes and actually makes the offering, you know? And in the tradition, he was not to accept that. And he accepted it, you know? And it really was a change because he went from this kind of disembodiment to a whole new kind of piece there. And one of them, it was interesting because the transcendent model, which is very much a male model, you know, is he actually switched and he accepted the feminine, you know, by taking the offering of some sujata. He said, okay, I will accept this. And now the story, it's a little complicated whether he just ate that one meal, but supposedly she fed him for like 7 days until he was strong enough. And then he went down to the river, and there's stuff called kusha grass. And he went down and took kusha grass, and he crossed over the river and went to what we know today as in Bodh Gaya, under the Bodhi tree, where he went, and there he made the resolve that now that his body was strong and his five aesthetic friends, you know, at that point, watching what he had done, you know, they turned away from him and left and said, you know, this guy's gone over, you know. And at that point, then he goes and he sits and makes the resolve not to move, you know. And he sits you know, they go, that's kind of what they call the four watches of the night. And, you know, he by just sitting, then all of his temptations and all the they call the armies of Mara. And there's a great painting in Sarnath in the temple there of the 10 armies of Mara, which come and really attack him, you know, and try to seduce him from not staying, you know. And in a way, this is an example that we've all been here sitting, and that we've all been attacked by our individual special Maras that came and tried to pull you off your seat, you know. But now you've come to the point you stayed, you know. And his awakening was not some grand, you know, transcendental thing. He realized something very simple and profound. Yeah. And simply that he stayed, he kind of didn't react to kind of desire and aversion, and actually broke through delusion. And he discovered something. You know, he did not discover nirvana, by the way. It has been there and always is there and is here in the space that we're in right now. He did not discover it, but he experienced it at a very deep level. You know. And by experiencing it, he recognized some very fundamental thing, you know. And the fundamental thing was that he then dubbed this not as some extreme, but what he called the middle way. And that middle way is not something that we have to leave the world over. It's something that we actually bring our full being to.
No.
Again, that middle way is the fundamentals here. And you're going to be back tomorrow in a world that is going to demand you to understand the middle way. No. So, really, the Buddha and his awakening. And I don't think we have to worry about nirvana too much. You know, it's not something that you can conceptualize. It's something that exists, and yet there is some sense of, oh, you know, if you open enough, you'll know what it is. You know. And one of the beauties of Ajahn Buddhadasa was he talked a lot about that in any moment where you're just simply present, then in that moment where you're neither deluded, you're not neither wanting, and you're not in an aversive state, then you could call it little nirvana. Yeah. And that was his kind of piece, is that, oh, here, you have this, and you can carry this with you everywhere. And it's not something that's highfalutin. It's something very pedestrian that is available to us. You know, and it's just moments that we completely are not. There's actually nobody there. There's just a moment of freedom that is only between moments, between thoughts. The middle way that you all will, in a sense, this is what's going to teach you. And I see that there's a lot of material out there that's very helpful. But more than anything, what we're doing here is an experiential piece. You know, it's simply not about the thinking or not about the setting up. It's simply the ability for just a fraction of a moment sometimes just to let go. No. And that letting go, it actually is the thing that adjusts us towards the middle way. It's actually what kind of draws us into it. So where does this go? You know, you all go back into the world tomorrow, and you know, this will be gone. You know, it too has a nature to arise. We have our time here, and then it passes away. So what is it? You know, can you take little moments of how you let go, or little moments of, you know, where you choose to simply pause. You know, it's an incredible activity to simply pause. It's something culturally that we don't understand. You know, it is actually less and less of our culture. You know, and so here you've had the kind of time to recognize the power of pause. There's a simple sutta that I always like to mention, and I'll read a little piece from it, that to me is the quintessential. If you get this, you got it. You know, it's like the culmination of this kind of thing. And it was an aesthetic who went searching for the Buddha and heard about the Buddha and said, "Oh, I need to find this man." You know. And he walked through India looking for the Buddha, and finally he found the Buddha and went to his monastery, and they said, "Oh, he's out on alms round, you know, don't disturb him, but I need to talk to him." So his name was Bhaiya, and Bhaiya was like one of these outrageous looking dudes, you know, his Bhaiya of the bark cloth. So he only, what he wore was from tree that had been softened into cloth. And so that's why they called him Bhaiya of the bark cloth. And he went searching for the Buddha. And he went into town. And one of the things is, if you ask the Buddha three times, he's got to say, "Yo." So Bhaiya goes up to him, and the Buddha says, "No, I can't do this right now. I can't teach you. You know, come back, after the alms round to the where they were camped or being taken care of." And so Bhaiya kind of backs off, and then he comes back again and asks a second time. And then he asks a third time. And the Buddha, in his great, you know, one of the beauties of a Buddha is they can see backwards and forwards. That time is, kind of a relative reality for them. And so he could see what was going to happen. So he actually said, "Okay, I'll give you these essential teachings, you know." And I'll read to you. There's several versions of this, but I have this one version I like. It's very kind of curt, short. "Then, Bhaiya, you should train yourself thus. In the seeing, let there be only the seeing. In the heard, let there only be the heard. In the sensed, let there only be the sensed. In the cognized, let there only be the cognized." You got it? Now you do know this. It's just this simple. "When, for you, there is only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, and only the sensed in the reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then Bhaiya, there is no you in terms of that. There is no you in the terms of that. When there is no you in the terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor there, nor between the two." Where is that? This, just this, is the end of stress. And at this point, just Bhaiya hearing the words of in the seen, there's just the seen. In the heard, there's just the heard. So there's no I anywhere in that. There is just simply that is known at the time, in that moment. You know. And he was so precise, and he worked so hard, that he went through the four stages of awakening right there. Now, what the Buddha and his great kind of vision saw, that Bhaiya, who was going to come back to the monastery, was in the marketplace, and a bull gored him and killed him. So he got the teachings in the most simple, direct way. That's how simple this is in some ways. You know? And we try to make up all this stuff about it, but that's really what it is. It's that simple. No. To actually make it really practical and take it into the world, I think one of the beauties of this is that we need to somehow really learn to, and in some sense, learn how to let go. Maybe that's as simple as is put, and not put so much emphasis on this selfing that happens, and that we find that we can start thinning that out. And then we start thinning that out, then there is, just like this evening, everybody jumping in to take care of things because it wasn't the way it was. You know, what was that? That was really the community recognizing its possibilities. You know, and I think there's a lot more here in the sense of community when it's no longer trying to think it out or control it or anything, but just in the simpleness of it. And that's really what I'm trying to emphasize. It's just the simpleness of it. Then we come together. We create, in a sense, community. You know, without, it's again, it goes back to my little statement, Dharma, not drama. You know? And so it begins to be Dharma. You know? And Dharma is simply the capacity to, by the way, you're all so intelligent. You know? If you can actually find that you have a sense of peace and ease and capacity to not be the director, you know, but actually simply be able to pause and allow that intelligence, which in some ways is self-monitoring, because it is understood something about letting go. You know, I really do appreciate, you know, this is, for me, this is your 11th, my 10th year here, and I've seen many of you over the years, you know, and it's changed. You're not the same people, you know. And what I see has changed is this little, you know, it slowly starts to kind of, sometimes I think, untangle your tangles. And you start understanding, you know, a lot of people that come to my talks, they don't understand a word I say, which is fine too. But you start understanding some of this stuff, you know? And it suddenly, you know, the power of letting go is not something cognized. It's something visceral. It's something like, oh, yeah, I know what that is. I know in my experience what it is. I read to you, this is also one of my favorite pieces. I can't not do this. And then maybe Dennis will have some wise words here about whatever we're up to or not up to. Always we hope, this is from Lao Tzu. Always we hope someone else has the answer. Some other place will be better. Some other time it will all turn out. This is it. No one else has the answer. No other place will be better. And it has already turned out. At the center of your being, you have the answer. You know who you are, and you know what you want. There is no need to run outside for better seeing. There is no need to run outside for better seeing, nor to peer from a window. Rather, abide at the center of your being. Rather, abide at the center of your being. For the more you leave it, the less you learn. Search your heart and see the way to do is to be.
so, this little incident this afternoon and this evening with Michelle, for me, was kind of a perfectly frames the question that John was answering of, like, where is this going or where does this take us? And I think this takes us one place in particular that I'd like to talk a little bit about, even though I'm a little distracted. So a little report. Michelle took a very hard, nasty fall and cut her hand and got a very nasty cut on her elbow. But the good news is that, you know, that it didn't break her elbow, didn't cut any tendons. So, you know, you get a big cut on your elbow and stitched up, you're going to be out of commission for a while, and that's going to happen, but she's going to be fine, and she's going to be real sore tomorrow and the next day, you know. And so I think we're just, like, unbelievably fortunate because she had this huge crystal plate, and, you know, when crystal falls, it explodes, you know. And so she had little glass chips every place, in her clothes and all in her arms. And so we're just so fortunate, you know, like she could have been hurt really severely. So, and I want to thank Kathy Vigren, Dr. Kathy Vigren, who just happened to be in the kitchen at the moment and then came and found me. And this is, of course, Kathy and I now have this down to an art, because during the pilgrimage, one member got really, really sick, and the two of us were kind of ministering to that person for a long time. And so when we got to Kathmandu, I said that I wanted to award the most compassionate yogi award to one person in the group, and it was Kathy. And she says, well, I don't even understand what that means. And she might not still understand what it means, but I think she's, of all the people I've ever met, she's one of the people that has the biggest heart and the most natural compassion. So thank you so much. So we're just really lucky that Michelle's okay. So where that takes me is I found the quote from the Dalai Lama. Okay. And the quotation is, naturally, most of us would like to die a peaceful death. But it is also clear we cannot hope to die peacefully if our lives have been full of violence or if our minds have been mostly agitated by emotions like anger, resentment, fear, attachment, and identification. So if we wish to die well, we must learn to live well. And so, I think in the sense of, like, a community like this, you know, where we've come together, there's a sangha, and then, you know, it's perfect, it's a perfect illustration of anicca and anatta, right? We create a certain set of conditions, we all come together, those conditions influence our state of mind, we reach this place of peace, we start feeling this whole connection between each other, and all of that is wholly dependent on the conditions. The conditions end tomorrow. It's gone. Anicca, anatta. But the sangha has no inherent substance to it. It's wholly dependent on people's intentions and creating a certain set of conditions. So I think one of the most, from the standpoint of being a sangha, and that's where I'm going with this, is maybe the most obvious condition is, well, how do we live together? And the Buddha, you know, stressed how important spiritual friendship was, right? We've heard all of those quotations. And my suspicion is that, you know, everybody kind of interprets that as, well, the reason the Buddha stress this so heavily is that spiritual friendship is, you know, so rich. You know, we're just so supported by spiritual friends. We learn so much. And I think that was part of it. And I think the other part is that the reality is living together under any circumstances frequently sucks. It's just difficult. And particularly in a spiritual context, we get, not this context, where everything is so set up properly, it's almost hard to get upset at somebody else. But in everyday Sangha community life, you know, you show up on Thursday nights and who knows who's in what mood and what they say and how they act, and it's easy to get triggered. And so the question for me is, one of the many questions is, well, how do we actually create a genuine Sangha, not just something where we show up occasionally and listen to a Dharma talk and then disperse? How do we do something more than that? And how this thing with Michelle tonight fits in for me is that in the last 6 weeks, 8 weeks, we've had two of our members diagnosed or announced that they've been diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment, you know, where you're starting to have memory loss, and depending on the degree of it, you know, it's significant, and depending on how fast it moves, it's the first stage of dementia and Alzheimer's. And we've had two members of the community experience TIAs, you know, these minor strokes. And we've had one member have a recurrence and a spread of cancer. And I received a note from both Vic and Roseanne DeFleming today, and they said to pass this on, that Roseanne is now in radiation therapy. They're hoping that that's going to really help her nausea, and you know, for the moment, they're encouraged. You know, there's finally kind of a clear path, and they're following. So, I mean, if we're truly a sangha, what are we doing about this? What are we doing to support each other and help each other? And so, if you look at the original sangha, you know, people joined that sangha voluntarily because they wanted to. And unlike many situations in Asia now, where people go and become monks not because they want to be enlightened or necessarily because they want to be a monk, it's because of their economic status or they're homeless and all kinds of other things, you know. But the original community, people joined it, and the Buddha said that there were these conditions about maintaining it, you know, where you would meet regularly together, that you would listen to and recite and memorize and discuss and debate and share the Dharma among yourselves, that you would meet with practitioners of your peer level and work together, that you would meet with people further down the path than you are and study together, and you would live together and try to embody the Dharma in the Vinaya, the precept in ethical conduct, you know, so that there was a whole infrastructure and that the purpose of the community was to help each individual awaken and for each person's conduct to support the awakening of everybody else's awakening in the community. And implicit in all of this, I think, was a very clear assumption that everyone, and I talked about this in some depth a couple of weeks ago, so I'm just going to kind of just go over it generally. There was an assumption that every single member of the Sangha had a responsibility to every other member of the Sangha, that everybody was watching out for each other, that they were actually a spiritual community. And if that was really true, then watching out for the welfare of your Dharma brother or your Dharma sister was a responsibility. Not a responsibility in the sense of an obligation. It's something that you wanted to do. Because the community was the expression of the Dharma, and your conduct was an expression of the Dharma, and the person next to you and in front of you and in back of you was an expression of the Dharma. And so this sense of support that really arose out of a sense of love for the Dharma. This is the way I feel. Of actually being in love with the Dharma and being in love with it expressing itself in every human life. And so that you would want to nurture that and take care of that and support it. And you felt the same way about the community, you know? So I think in the West, frankly, I think this is a little kind of a foreign idea. And we're joiners, you know, there's all these organizations and you join and you have these loose affiliations. And I think maybe this is something other than that. Or at least it's possible. And you've heard me, many of you have heard me tell a story, but in this context, hopefully it's meaningful that another experience that we had in India that has really stuck with me was we had this bus driver whose name was Shyam. And, we all thought that Shyam was a bus driver and didn't realize that he was actually, you know, a bodhisattva or some little awakened being or something in disguise. Because just over and over and over again, we've found him just kind of appearing to take care of us. And it's just wild, you know. So, the very first stop we made in Rajgir, where the bamboo grove is, we went in to register everybody, and the drill is everybody stays in the bus, you know, and we go in and register with the passports and everything, and then the owner of the hotel wanted to work out the menu right then, and he hands us this thing that's like 8 pages long, you know, with little dinky type, you know, and of course none of it's in English, and it's like, well, what would you like, you know, for lunch and dinner, and so he's kind of trying to translate, and so all of a sudden, the bus driver, Shyam, is like just over my shoulder, and he's saying, oh, okay, well, you know, this one here, he says, you know what that is, and he describes it broken, and he says, that would really be good, you know, for lunch, and then this one, and so, like, with his help, we ended up making up the menu, and then later in the day, we load off the bus, and a lot of people go down to the public market. And at one end of the public market, it's a little rougher, you know, probably where we don't want people going. And particularly, you know, the women members of the group, and a couple people come back and say, hey, you know, we were out in the market, and we were down there, and all of a sudden, Shyam was there. You know, and he was kind of showing us stuff and what have you. And, you know, I just kept listening to it. And I don't know if they recognized, but it was very clear what was going on. It was like Shyam was acting like very nonchalant and like steering everybody, like, no, back this way, right? Like, we don't want you in there. So then we're having dinner that night, and, you know, we're all sitting down at the buffet. And I look up and I go, Is that Shyam back in the kitchen? And, you know, you couldn't actually see back in the kitchen, but you could see right at the door. And he's inspecting everything they're bringing out. And he's telling some of them, no, you take that back, you know? You know, like, it's basically like, that's not good enough for my people, you know? So as the trip went on, there was just like all these illustrations, and it just became clear that there was some kind of really unusual level of affection that this guy felt towards us, and it wasn't obligation, because this is not the role of a bus driver, you know, And my guess is that if I told the travel service that the bus driver was in the kitchen and everything, mm-hmm. that, you know, that I don't know what it would have been. But it's definitely not the role of the bus driver. And this went to the extent that when we one of our members got really quite sick, that it's like 10 o'clock at night, and we're up there, and you know, we're helping him, and you know, putting cold packs on him and stuff, and there's a knock on the door, and it's Sean. And he's got two little cartons of cold fruit chews. And he says, well, I just wanted to bring by something. And then, I don't even know how this happened. It happened so quick. The next thing I know, I look over, and he's giving him a massage. Like, how'd that happen? You know? So, and I mean, just on and on and on. And when we went to Kathmandu, there's a very, very long bus ride from where we were to Lumbini. Terrible roads, and the bus broke down. And so three of us, for reasons that don't matter, couldn't get on the plane. We were on their small planes. They had to wait for the next plane. So Sham kind of gave us, well, I think what we thought we heard, I don't think he said this, but what we thought he told us was that he was going to go and sleep in the bus and wait until the night and then drive back, because the traffic pattern back to Varanasi, which is where he was going to go, which is really a long drive, you know, would be better. And so the 12 of us take off on this flight, and the ones who are left look over and they see Sham at the window outside, you know, looking in and, you know, checking to make sure that we got off. And basically, he was not going to leave until every single one of us got on a plane and he was sure that we were safe. You know, so I think almost everybody ended up having this real sense of affection for him, and he and I got, you know, we were speaking broken English, and I don't know any Hindi, and we're doing a lot of hand gestures and stuff, and we got to be real buddies. You know, it's frequent. Everybody would load off the buses and go someplace, and he and I would just sit in the front of the bus, you know, and just frequently we just sit there together and, you know, kind of look at each other and be satisfied that we were, you know, kind of together taking care of all these people, you know. And so this is really a nice bus, and it had this big, big, big glass panoramic window, huge. And from the ceiling, there was a string, and then there was this little rubber white beam that was like prone, like it's flying, like a human being, you know, like this. And it had something in each arm. Looked like he had a little helmet on. So at one point I said to Mo Sham, you know, what is this little thing that's hanging here, you know? Because every place we're going, it's right, you know, the whole trip. And he says, well, that's Hanuman. And I said, well, I know Hanuman. You know, I know that, because before I came to Buddhist practice, that's who I practiced with. I practiced with the Hindu teacher, and Hanuman has many different incarnations and is interpreted in many different ways, but one way, and this was the way Sham was interpreting him, was that he was a representative god of service. And so, you know, he is very respectful to me and also very affectionate. Like, we're still in communication. He sends me emails. In fact, the night before last, he called in the middle of the night. I picked up the phone in the morning and I looked, and I know the phone number because it's Varanasi. You know, it's like, wow, how does he know we're all together, you know? So, and like, he calls me Daddy, which is a sign of respect, you know, for the older man. So the only time when he did or said anything where he kind of looked at me like, so I said to him, well, why Hanuman? And he kind of looked at me like, what? Why would you even ask me that? I mean, it was that kind of a look, you know? And then he said, well, Hanuman's here to protect me so I can protect you. Mm-hmm. You know? And that has really stuck with me, that that there was such a clear, straight line between his spiritual intention and his conduct. And for me, that's like, you know, I'm that's what I am trying to do. I am trying to find that straight line, and that's what I'm trying to help other people do. And so that takes me back to community. And, you know, members of the community who are sick and getting sick and all these different things. It seems to me that if, in fact, we really are a spiritual community, I mean, we keep throwing that around. If we really are, then we need to reflect on what that deeply means and what kind of responsibility we have to each other and up our game as a community. We need to, I mean, think of all the resources and the size of a community that we have that we could mobilize for somebody who's sick, rather than it's just their friends mobilizing, you know? But that we could mobilize and make things available. They get the choice of whether they want to use them. But we create that. And so I think that there's a myriad number of ways if we say that this actually is the or one of the most important things in our lives. I mean, if we actually say that to ourselves, I believe that the natural consequence of that is that anyone else who is saying that and trying to practice with us is actually, in the deepest sense of the word, our brother or our sister, and probably in a much deeper way than our blood brother or our blood sister. And that we should reflect on what that means as a community. I don't know. I don't have any suggestions. I don't know what that means. All I know is that I've gotten to that place now. And I want to start talking about this. And maybe the answer is, maybe the community doesn't think there's anything. I find that hard to believe if we deeply reflect on this. But I want to open that dialogue. And I want to open what it would look like and what it would mean if we actually really cared for each other. Not just when we're sick, although I think this is a huge piece, but that piece. And then what would that mean, like, so many of us here? You know, we've entered a certain stage of life. So rather than, like, all of us kind of having the same questions and, I think, at some level kind of suffering and feeling like we're suffering in isolation almost, what do we do to help each other? You know, I mean, like, I'm thinking maybe the most obvious is that maybe we have an affinity group or more than one affinity group on aging. You know, but we start a dialogue of how what we've been doing here, this precious thing, can inform the rest of our life when we're not here, and inform it in a different, deeper way, and it can inform it in the most difficult and troubling questions that we may be facing or asking ourselves. That's the piece for me. Easy to show up, listen to a Dharma talk, and go home. That's really easy. It's quite another thing to be getting ready to go to bed and you look down and notice that all the skin on your arms are wrinkling here, and you have the thought of what it means to be aging and having a fear of isolation and dying and what have you, you know. So that's it. You know, I just putting it out there. I really want to start this dialogue. And if you're interested in that, I'd like you to talk with me about it. Mm. And I'm asking your help, too. Because I would like to see our community actually become a true Dharma community. That's what I would like to see. I'm not sure what that means, other than I know that it means that if we actually believe that we're all in this together, in the Dharma, that we have some greater responsibility for each other and for the community itself. So,
I'd like to just end this perfect piece here. It's from Shantideva. May I be a guard for those that need protection, a guide for those on the path, a boat, a raft, a bridge for those that wish to cross the rushing stream, a lamp in the darkness, a resting place for the weary, a healing medicine for all who are sick, a vase of plenty and a tree of miracles. And for all the boundless multitudes of living beings, may I bring sustenance and awakening, enduring like the earth and the sky, until all beings are free from sorrow and all beings are awake.